Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast. On this week's episode, we'll be discussing Vladimir Putin's information wars, grammar schools in Kent, and whether we're all getting excited about Halloween a little too early. This week saw the controversial move by NatWest to freeze the bank accounts of the broadcaster Russia Today. The decision has subsequently been reversed, but the question remains, was there a political aspect to it? And should Britain be involving itself in Russia's propaganda war? This is the subject that Paul Wood and Rod Liddell tackle in this week's cover piece, and I'm joined now to discuss this issue by former BBC and Voice of Russia journalist Dmitry Linick and from Washington DC, Ben Judah. So Dmitry, can you summarise what's happened this week between NatWest and Russia Today?
I don't think anybody can, but from what I know, the situation is slightly confusing and probably confused in that, the first thing we hear about this is that RT comes up with this quote from the RBS or NatWest statement saying that your accounts have been closed, that's a final decision, no further recourse. The next thing, of course, RBS and NatWest are 70% British government owned. The Russian ministry, foreign ministry, Moscow says, oh, the British government must have had a finger in the pie. The British government comes out, says, so we have nothing to do with it. The next thing is RBS or NatWest comes up with a statement. We're looking in the situation. We're not sure where it's going, and we're hopefully going to sort it out. So there's a lot of confusion on all sides, and that's where we're at.
And Ben, do you detect a political hand behind this?
There has been, over the last few years, a strengthening of banks' know-your-clients procedures and anti-corruption and anti-money laundering procedures. And if a major blue-chip bank gets this wrong, they have very large fines to pay, and it can be an extremely kind of time-wasting situation for them to be in, and they can lose money out of this. And one possibility which we shouldn't discount is that within RBS there has been a decision to review clients coming from highly corrupt countries like the Russian Federation.
And Dmitry, in Paul's piece this week, he suggests that the Baltic states are becoming increasingly worried about a Russian invasion. Do you think there's any evidence to suggest that might be on the cards?
Well, I first want to go back to what Ben's just said. If the RBS regulation or letter, whatever, were based in some sort of doubts about RT's clarity, financial sort of soundness, then that's what a letter should have said. But without giving any reasons, that does sound like a politically motivated step to me.
Unfortunately, they can't do that because of libel issues. So if they were doing a review for money laundering purposes, they'd have to keep that internal. So that
then let's check first and issue statements later.
Well, normally, if you were reviewing a client for money laundering purposes, they wouldn't be a broadcaster which is set up to promote a vision of Russia as a beleaguered force in the world. So it's a tricky client to deal with from their point of view.
Well, to me, it sounds totally like a lame situation. Now, going over to the Baltics, I think it's one of those things, sort of Russia rattling the sabers, rattling the nuclear saber, whatever. This is outlandish. This is completely out of this world. This is completely irrational. Anybody with a sort of any indication of an idea of what's going on in Russia, of any understanding of what Russia is about and what Russia's thinking is, cannot seriously think that Russia is about to invade Baltic states.
But Dmitry, why is there so much paranoia then within the Baltic states?
Within the Baltic states, well, it's a profound question, but essentially it's sort of to be seen in many countries, if not in all countries, of the post-Soviet space, so-called, the former republics. There are differences of opinion in all of those republics. Maybe a minority now believe that Russia is no threat, and maybe a majority believe that Russia is a threat. But this majority opinion of Russia being aggressive and out to attack is given prominence, undue prominence, in the media, in the Western media, particularly the British media.
Ben, do you think that the Baltic states are right to be worried about an imminent invasion?
I travel regularly to the region and regularly to the Baltic states, and I have the chance to speak with the leadership of those countries, both civil and military. And I can tell you that before Russia's invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea, there was a real worry in Estonia and Latvia that something was being planned, that troops were being moved, that a shock force might attempt something. And that has actually gone down slightly. And the reason is that any major army, it could be the British army, it could be the Russian army, it could be the American army, huge figures on paper, 800,000 troops, 1.2 million troops, 250,000 troops, but there are very few of them which are actually battle ready. And in Russia, this is a quite pronounced case. And Russia has a few excellent paratrooper brigades which were deployed to Crimea, and they performed their mission magnificently. And when those troops were deployed there was initially a great kind of sigh of relief in the Baltic, along with a sort of gasp of horror that those troops were being deployed there for the time being.
And Dmitry, in Paul Wood's piece, he suggests that Russia has been gripped by what he calls World War III hysteria. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I think it's as fair as it is with regard to the UK or the Baltic Republics or Poland or some of those other countries, such as Ukraine, of course, and Georgia. There's a number of countries where this sort of attitude to Russia as an imminent threat is taking the upper hand. It's irrational, in my core belief. But that's a fact of life. That's something we have to live with. The way Russia is portrayed in the West, in British media in particular, I find deplorable, really, of late. It started long before Ukraine. It started long before Crimea. One perhaps thing of note was the coverage of the Sochi Olympics in the run-up to 2013. And if you recall, every outlet here, not just the tabloids, but the sort of mainstream reputable papers and channels, they lavishly quoted Stephen Fry's words to the effect that, you know, Russia's attitude to gays is awful, and they're castigated, they're sent to the salt mines. I've yet to see a single report from a salt mine where those gays have been marched to. I know that 40 countries of the Commonwealth criminalize gays, while Russia doesn't, and yet it's Russia that is the bad guy. And the same goes for military matters. Yes, Ben is probably right in that, you know, Russia has only a few thousand of elite troops, but that's not about that. It's just not on the cards. I mean, the general staff of Britain, of Russia, of Timbuktu, whatever, has theoretical plans of, I don't know, dealing with a crisis in Brazil. Yes, that's what general staffs do, but that doesn't mean they're going to land there.
And Ben, do you think it's strange that we hold Russia up to a higher moral standard than other countries?
Well, I'd first like to say that World War III isn't what it used to be, and that there may be a war hysteria and people using this word, but they're not really talking about sliding into that 1984-like situation straight out of the fantastic anti-war movie Freds. What people are worried about is just an escalation of skirmishes, border skirmishes, plane skirmishes between NATO and Russia, between the countries in between and Putin's forces, and that melting down like this more peaceful than not situation in Eastern Europe. So I wouldn't fear like imminent atomic strikes. What has been very interesting is that the Russian propaganda and disinformation complex has been trying to promote this idea of World War III. It's been spinning it out of the embassy, it's been planting stories in the Western media, various Russian governors and Russian state media outlets have been doing this. Now, why would you, when the situation is, as Mr. Linux correctly said, is not one comparable to the great crises of the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the war scare of 1984 during the Able Archer military exercise? Well, the reason is rather more prosaic, which is that due to Russia's very weak economy, Russia is attempting to play a global power role with an economy smaller than that of Spain. Russia's attempting to play a hostile role to the West when The West is the main consumer of its resources, and the West is its key and essential banker. And sanctions placed on the key oligarchical structures and key Russian state banks and oil companies following the invasion of Ukraine have started to bite. And as a consequence, this is really pushing Russia into elements of sort of budgetary crisis. So what we're going to see over the next year is a 35% cut in the Russian healthcare budget. We're also going to see a cut in the military budget. Well, time and time again, in various moments of not just Putin's regime, but regimes all over the world since the time of the Romans and the Greeks, a good little bit of war hysteria can calm people over and pass you onto the next phase of your political stage.
But Ben, you mentioned the propaganda war. I suppose what's quite interesting about what seems to be happening now is that the West is almost being played at its own game, that these vast amounts of emails that are being leaked. Putin's almost sort of using journalistic tactics to show up, you know, where the West is failing in itself. Do you not think that's quite clever on Putin's part?
I think it's been an impressive disinformation operation, sure. I think there have been some really high-quality spin.
But is it spin, though, if there's an element of truth to it?
Well, it's part of a larger... The Russian disinformation war, of which these little elements of the US election is a much broader project. And more or less, over the last 5 or 6 years, that's been quite impressive. What I do believe has happened is it is dramatically overreached, and that the consequences of having attempted to interfere, spin the American media, to harm the Clinton campaign is going to have a very bad effect on what Putin desires out of his relationship with the United States. Putin is endlessly talking about how he desires to have a relationship with the United States comparable to the relationship that Roosevelt had with Stalin. Putin wants to have a sort of Yalta agreement in which Europe and the world and the Middle East will be carved up into spheres of influence. And these tactics that he's pursued within the broader context of the US election campaign are going to push him a lot further away from that and are going to make what he actually fears a lot harsher, a lot more likely.
Dmitry?
Well, to that I would want to say that you're talking continuously about Russia's disinformation campaign. I think it applies equally to the Western media coverage of Russia. And I've mentioned some of the things that I find delectable. In that regard, I'm not claiming that Russian press is 100% accurate and truthful and whatnot. There are ways and means of sort of achieving one's propaganda aims, and that applies to both sides. As someone who's worked for Russian media for 20 years and for British media for 20 years, I can kind of, you know, pass judgment on that. You know, political correctness seems to apply to everybody now but the Russians. So there's a stereotype, an accepted stereotype, and some people are happy to embrace it, that, you know, he's drunk as the Russians, he's as aggressive as the Russians, he's as thick as the Russians, or whatever. That is the stereotype that is being cemented in the minds of people, and they're totally wrong and dangerous.
And finally, one thing we haven't mentioned yet is Syria. Dmitry, do you think that things are getting out of hand there?
I don't know if one can class this as a proxy war already, but sort of the major powers that are behind the forces that are actually on the battleground are engaged in a war by proxy. And that is very dangerous. And when the Russian defense ministry says that we're going to target the other side's airplanes, and the Americans say the same thing about Russia. Now, I find that really, really dangerous.
And Ben, do you think it's more likely that we'd go to war over Syria rather than over the Baltic states?
Well, again, we're talking in these very sort of Cold War terms about, like, what a war is and what a war isn't. Is there a risk of maybe a dogfight between American and Russian planes, the way there was a dogfight between Russian and Turkish planes? Yes, I mean, that's possible. I don't think it's likely, but I think it's possible. Is there a risk of Russian forces bombing American proxies in Syria where there will be some British or American special forces there? Yes, that's possible. Is there a risk of escalating sanctions? Yes, that's possible. Is there a risk of Red Alert 2, revenge of Stalin-style scenes of the Russian army rushing into Europe in a blitzkrieg? No.
That was Dmitry Linick and Ben Judah. In Yacenda Maxtone Graham's hometown of Sandwich, Kent, there are two schools, a rather shabby grammar and a shiny tech comprehensive. But behind the impressive veneer lies the fundamental issue of selective education. Pupils who pass the so-called Kent test and get into a grammar often do far better than their counterparts who fail at 11 and are left behind. To discuss the cutthroat world of academic selection, I'm joined by Yacenda and also by Toby Young. So Yacenda, in your piece this week, you say that if you want to see the future of education, look to Kent. So what's going on there?
Well, I was brought up as it happens, in Sandwich, a pretty town in East Kent. And I suppose now I come to think of it, I'm completely used to that atmosphere in a town where there is the better school and the slightly less good school at the other side of the town, and the two completely different textures of children you feel that come from each one. One who are, as it were, sometimes I feel they're slightly the saved and the unsaved. The ones who are lucky enough to have passed the Kent test, which is the 11 plus voluntary exam, that you either pass or you fail. And if you do, you can go to Sir Roger Manwood's. And if you don't, you go to Sandwich Technology School, which I'm sure is very good in its way, but it's just a different world. And
so you think that's a bad thing, having these two separate worlds?
That is the question, because I really see both sides of the argument very strongly. There's part of me that loves that sense of a homogenous group of bright, motivated children being, in a way, creamed off, but given the best that can be available and given the possibility of great futures in professions, and that could happen to any child of any from any class. But I do also then see the terrible disadvantage that the other ones seem like losers and feel like losers.
And Toby, does the situation in Kent worry you?
Well, I guess I feel conflicted about new grammars as well. But I did want to point out that the penalty that children who don't go to grammars in selective areas pay is often exaggerated. You say in your piece that successive studies have shown that the presence of grammar schools normally means the other schools are worse than they would be in mixed ability areas. And that's certainly the consensus view. But there was a research paper published by David Laws's new think tank called the Education Policy Institute last month. It was called Grammar Schools and Social Mobility, and it was looking at what the likely impact of new grammar schools would be on social mobility, and in particular on neighbouring schools in those areas where they set up. And one of its findings, rather surprisingly, was that nationally there is certainly a bonus, a GCSE bonus, for those children attending grammars. They do better in their 8 best GCSE subjects, and they calculated that the bonus is worth roughly a third of a grade per subject. But interestingly, they said that there wasn't a corresponding penalty paid on average by children not attending grammar schools in selective areas. And one of their most eye-opening findings was that for children on free school meals, those children on free school meals attending the non-selective schools in selective areas actually do better than children on free school meals do in comprehensive areas. Now, it did point out that in the most selective areas, those areas with the most selective places, like Kent, which had quite a high concentration of grammar schools, the bonus that children get from going to grammars is slightly smaller, and there is a penalty that children pay, but it's not that big. So for children not attending grammars in highly selective areas like Kent, the penalty is minus 0.1 of a GCSE grade across their 8 best GCSE subjects. For children on free school meals, it's slightly higher. It's minus 0.2, but it's still quite
tiny.
Small. So if that's the kind of linchpin of the case against new grammars, that they have a negative impact on neighbouring schools, and for every child that benefits from going to the grammar, several children suffer in virtue of going to the secondary modern or whatever it calls itself. That's not a particularly strong argument.
But didn't we hear today about schools just not even thinking about Oxbridge for their children who are at more, as it were, bog standard schools, just not even being allowed to mention university? And that surely is not,
not
a good thing.
That's certainly another argument against selective education. My big concern is that, as someone who has helped set up a secondary school, which is non-selective in West London, and which calls itself a comprehensive grammar, our sort of founding principle is that all children, regardless of ability, can benefit from an academically challenging curriculum. So we expect all the children to do Latin.
But there's any test to get in?
No test to get in at all, no.
So in what ways? It's not a grammar at all then?
Well, it's a grammar in the sense that it teaches a grammar school curriculum, and we imagine, we like to tell ourselves that we have grammar school standards of behaviour at the school, which I think we largely do. But the problem I have with more selection is it embeds the idea that that kind of curriculum is only suitable for those in the top 25% of the ability spectrum and not for everyone. So it encourages a more two-tier approach to curriculum.
Yes, and
curriculum
design. What one wants is for the, as it were, the lesser schools, so-called, to actually raise their game and become as good as the grammars. And that's the ideal world. And why can't that happen? Why does that not happen? Why do schools become demoralised?
Well, I think it, those in favour of more grammars would say, well, it would be fantastic if all schools were as good as the best comprehensives. And if they were, there probably wouldn't be a pressing need for any more grammar schools. But for those parents who live in areas which aren't served by good comprehensives, they don't have access to good comprehensive schools.
You can't do A-levels in whole swathes of...
If you're a parent of a bright child in an area like that, and you can't afford to move to an area where there are better schools, you can't afford to go private, so you can't go to a private selective school, you're kind of bereft. Your child is not going to realise his or her potential. So the argument is in those areas, rather than wait for all schools to become better,
let's
introduce some really good selective schools in those areas,
yeah,
so those children at least
can
have a chance.
Can at least get rescued now.
It's part of the issue here, teachers, because in your piece, Sandy, you say how the best teachers go to the grammars and then the worst ones end up at
Yes, perhaps you would have a system like the Catholic Church where priests just get sent to churches with no choice. If the best teachers got sent to...
Yeah, I haven't seen any research about that. It may be true, but I think it was probably truer in the 1950s and 60s than it is now. And I would have thought that the prejudice against grammar schools is so widespread that it extends to, you know, graduates of Russell Group universities who want to go into teaching.
And therefore they'll
go and teach at an academy or a free school or a comprehensive rather than a grammar.
Because they're ideologically opposed to the idea of grammar schools.
And
good for them, they're probably doing marvellous jobs. The problem is, I suppose, you've got this underbelly of unmotivated
children, and
three disruptive children, as we know, in a whole school can really bring a school down.
Of course.
And that's what you're... How do you deal with that?
And just going on to Theresa May, because obviously she's talking a lot about grammar schools at the moment, she is also using the word meritocracy, which is a word that your father invented, Toby. Are you pleased to hear this being bandied around?
Well, it's a slightly double-edged sword, because, yeah, I'm pleased that a word invented by my father is still being used. But it certainly isn't being used in the way he originally intended it to be used. When he coined the word, it was to describe a dystopian society of the future. And he very much disapproved of meritocracy. He was an egalitarian, and he thought that rewarding merit and structuring a society on that basis was just another way of buttressing inequality. And he saw it as a kind of alternative to a kind of more feudal, inherited system of inequality, but which was ultimately no better and in some ways worse, because at least in a hereditary system, those at the bottom of the pile can tell themselves they just happen to be born in the wrong class. But in a meritocracy, somehow people at the bottom feel as though their status is more deserved because they lack merit, and that's why they're at the bottom. So he thought in some ways it was worse, because it's more kind of rational and robust and more defensible than other forms and other principles for organising inequality.
That's what we don't want to hear about. That's what you hear about these children who get so demoralised on hearing that they've failed, and that can affect the rest of their lives.
But later on, obviously, people then apply to university and will fail to get into, say, Oxbridge. Is there not an argument saying that you start that procedure earlier?
Well, as I mentioned in my piece, that the private school world is rife with selection and assessment from the age of three.
And do you think that's a good thing?
Well, it's good and bad. I was asking my son today, who's 14 and gone to perhaps not top-notch, but a perfectly normal, good private school. And he said, absolutely fine. He's absolutely fine that there are these tiers. And children can deal with it.
Because, I mean, do you think children can deal with it? Do you think some children just get on with it and recognise that they are not as necessarily as clever as everyone else?
I remember when I failed all my O-levels, bar one, I rang up my mother and with the letter with the results on it in my hand and said, "Mum, I just don't think I'm academically bright." And I was expecting her to kind of vigorously dispute this, but she just sort of accepted it, and I think was relieved that I'd accepted it too. And of course, I later changed my mind. But so I didn't have too much difficulty with it. But my solution to this conundrum is to allow for more partially selective schools to be set up, or to allow existing schools, which are currently non-selective, to become partially selective, but to cap the number of places they can set aside as selective places at around 25%.
To have a grammar school stream, as it were.
And I visited this school in Rugby called Ashlawn School, which selects 12.5% of its children, and the rest are comprehensively admitted. I shouldn't say just, because I don't mean to imply that they're in any way inferior.
Yeah.
And it actually seems to work very well. That those 12.5% form the kind of nucleus of the grammar stream.
But they don't get mercilessly teased by the rest of the school.
What they then do, 240 children admitted each year, 30 form the nucleus of the grammar stream, and then they move 90 other children into the grammar stream. So half, 120 children in total, are in the grammar stream. Mm. And there's quite a lot of movement in and out of the grammar stream, so you don't have that sort of...
Can you move down from the grammar stream?
You can move down and you can move up. So there's downward and upward mobility. But you don't have that sense of children's fate being set in stone at the age of 11 when they're sorted into sheep and goats, which is one of the kind of main objections people have to selection. And it seems to work quite well. I mean, the children, I spoke to some children in year 8 in the grammar stream, some of whom had passed the 11 plus, some of whom had just been promoted into the grammar stream. And they seem to, you know, be friends with children who weren't in the grammar stream. Mm. They all mix in the playground, people they were friends with at primary school. And there's also the kind of exchange of intellectual capital you get at a good comprehensive. So they say that their friends who aren't in the grammar stream, who struggle with their homework, are completely uninhibited about asking them for help, and they're happy to help. They called it an inclusive selective school, and it just seemed to be a great model, which might be a better way of helping children in areas where there aren't any sort of good schools. You could have some schools introduce, you know, the grammar stream, so those children will be looked after at those schools, and that's an easier solution than setting up fully-fledged new grammars.
And what, you build a new building for a new grammar school, and you build a...
Well, you wouldn't need a new building in the case of these schools.
Exactly,
it would be a pretty cheap solution to the problem. Yeah.
And one thing you also mentioned in your piece, Zander, is wealthier parents being able to game the system by sending their children to a private primary school or employing tutors. Is there any way, Toby, we send of overcoming that, or is that always going to be a function?
I think, I mean, you know, parents will do anything they can. You lie awake, you have years of insomnia, as I said, planning and plotting how to get your child the best education you can, and they will get round any system to beat it. I mean, I've heard that, for example, in Tunbridge Wells, 40% of people pass the 11 class, whereas in Dover and Folkestone, 12% pass.
Yeah.
Tunbridge Wells being the more affluent.
Yes. I mean, I think people talk quite glibly about coming up with a tutor-proof test. Well, that's actually very, very difficult, as you say in your piece. You know, if you practice something often enough, you're going to get better at it. And so those children who've practiced the 11 plus, who've been tutored, are going to find it easier than those who haven't.
That was Yacenda Maxton-Graham and Toby Young. And finally, in the Irish tradition of Halloween, children would dress in their parents' clothes, go begging for nuts, and eat a yeast bread that predicted their marriage prospects. Not so anymore, says Melanie McDonough, as the spooky season has now been taken over both by killer clowns and crass consumerism. Melanie argues that we should stop celebrating everything so soon, starting with Halloween. She joins me now to defend a simpler time. So Melanie, in your piece you detail a rather kind of lovely image of what Halloween used to be like, but you now say it's changed. How has it changed?
Changed beyond recognition. I have a theory that the Irish Halloween went to America with the immigrants, and it actually returned from America completely transformed for the worse. So it started out as quite a venerable kind of folk tradition, and it came back a bit like Irish pubs, completely commercialised, and turned into a kind of festival of chocolate, crossed with an opportunity to see gore on film. So the essentials of the thing was that it was 2 days before the Day of the Dead, so it did have a sort of ghosty kind of element. And people did go around dressed in their parents' clothes, their faces either blackened in the old days or with masks, sort of more recently. And you did hammer on people's doors and you were looking for apples and nuts, some money. But what you never got was chocolate. And then there were a few little harmless kind of costumes you had on the day. There was bobbing for apples and indeed for money. So you'd all dive in and try and, with your hands behind your back, and try and get an apple out, or kind of 50 pence a piece. And there'd be things like holding an apple, which is harder than it looks, suspended by a string between two people, and you've each got to try and take a bite. There were kind of little games like that. And then there's barmbrack, which is a kind of fruited yeast bread. which is actually really delicious, quite plain, very good buttered. And it had always a little wedding ring in, and so whoever got that would be the next to marry. If you made your own, there was other kind of divination. So if you got a match stick in it, that would be poverty for the year ahead, so you didn't want to get that. So there were kind of bona fide customs on the night. But the thing about it was that there was a very short lead time. The night before was called banging night, so you went around, as the name suggests, and you hammered on people's doors and ran away before they got there. So you're just a complete nuisance to your neighbours. Then there wasn't any kind of overhang, so you got ready kind of on the day, and you might have kind of bought stuff in a couple of days beforehand. But there was not the phenomenon that you have now, that there's kind of a month of preparedness. And that's the phenomenon, I think, that's common to every sort of festivity or every aspect of the seasons now. There is this terrifically long lead time because it's been so commercialised that the merchandise has to be sort of pre-prepared and got in early. And so the entire season has become upended. So it ends up being effectively celebrated way before its time. And by the time you get to the night itself, it's a bit anticlimactic.
Yeah. And I mean, I've already noticed advent calendars appearing alongside Halloween.
It's pure horror. I've been looking at the Christmas merchandise for at least a fortnight now in Marks and Spencer's. So you've got this very odd sort of colour scheme. You've got sort of scarlet and gold for the Christmas shelves, and you've got black and orange for the pumpkin Halloween shelves. And it's really discordant and really unsettling because you're working in advance of time in both cases. But because of the commercial imperative to get things out, preferably at full price so you can discount them later, you are going to be sort of overcome with this kind of visual imagery way ahead of the event. So by the time it actually gets to Christmas week, you're going to be completely sated with the scarlet and gold sort of motif, and all the kind of flavours and smells of Christmas are going to be very familiar because you've been living with them since the end of November, or in our case, since the end of October. And so the former sort of dynamic of the seasons has been completely upended.
But is it not the case that holidays like Easter and Christmas have always had a lead time with Lent and Advent? Is it just that we're celebrating it in a slightly different way?
Well, you didn't actually celebrate it in the old period of preparedness in the run-in. The run-in to Lent, to Easter was Lent, and that was terrifically opposed to the notion of celebrating. So you're going through fast and self-denial on the journey to Lent. And Advent was a period of preparedness as well, which is very different in character from the celebratory aspect of Christmas. So the kind of music you'd play would be quite different from the Christmas carols, which you now get played throughout the Christmas season, which now starts kind of, as I say, in November. And people actually feel a bit cheated if they get a proper Advent carol service rather than a Christmas carol service, which is what they're used to. And in Germany, a neighbour who grew up in the East said that the kind of music that was played during Advent was rather quiet, rather reflective, not the full-blown celebratory stuff which you should get from Christmas Eve onwards. So you do indeed have a time when you are getting ready for the event, and obviously you're kind of buying presents and things like that. But the whole notion of the Christmas party season starting before Christmas is to upend the entire nature of the festivity.
And then I suppose, as you say in your piece, straight after Christmas, at the point when everyone should be celebrating, that's when everyone starts going on diets.
So, well, exactly.
It's sort of not the right way around.
Yes, Hilaire Belloc used to wait until 5 o'clock on Christmas Eve and then bring the Christmas tree in and start to decorate it the night before. So for a normal Christian festivity, what you've got is the vigil the night before for any feast day, and in the case of Christmas and Easter, a very long lead time. And then you have a kind of explosive character to the event itself, so it just happens bang. And then you go on to celebrate it for the next 8 days in the case of a normal festivity, and in the case of Christmas and Easter, for very much longer. And in the case of Christmas, it starts Christmas Eve and goes on in a kind of crescendo up until Twelfth Night and the Epiphany, when the three kings come. And that finishes on a high note in every sense. And you have a particular kind of dynamic to those 12 days. As you say, what we have now instead is the New Year, New You, New Year's resolution, fast and abstinence coming in on New Year's Day. And that's right in the middle of the 12 days of Christmas. So actually, the festive period, the proper festive period, is abruptly terminated just when it should be getting into full swing. So you've got actually the converse of what should be the normal dynamic of the Christmas season, and indeed of any festivity.
That was Melanie McDonough. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? You can read all the features discussed in the podcast, as well as great pieces by Matt Ridley, Mary Wakefield, and James Bartholomew.
And we have a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.